Good morning, everybody. Proud of you for coming here on a hot day, on a holiday weekend. That's, you all got your priorities right. So there are sermon notes in the app this time. You don't really need them while I'm talking, I don't think. I put in there the two takeaways that I hope I'll get, that I will actually state, I hope, and some quotes that I thought were super interesting, and also we're going to be talking about biblical imagery in some of the places in Scripture where I pulled those from. And I did it again. It was a big passage, and so there's a lot of talking from me today, and I will not be offended if you want to walk around or do jumping jacks or have your neighbor slap you on the face like, wake up, she's still talking. So it's okay. I'm not offended at all. I won't be at all. Our passage is huge. We've just passed the halfway point in the Gospel of Mark. And what am I going to say? It's a big chunk of passage. Big chunk. We're going to read the whole thing. It's six slides of text, and then hopefully it'll be seared into your brain, and then the rest of the time we won't have as many wordy slides up there. So today, here is our passage. Oh, I forgot to put it in my notes, so I'm going to have to read it with you. Now I know it's even longer, because that would have been like another whole page. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah." For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." And suddenly, looking all around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And so they asked him, "Why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come?" And he said to them, "Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him." And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them, and the scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And Jesus answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. Is that the last one? Okay. So today is one of those Sundays when I was preparing this passage, or preparing the message for that passage. The passage, it didn't feel coherent together. Like, why would Mark put these two events, these two episodes, so close together? Are these passages in conversation with each other? What does Mark want us to take away by considering them both together? Or maybe we aren't supposed to. Maybe they don't go together. But that seems kind of crazy, because why would Mark, who up till now has so carefully arranged and composed his gospel, suddenly go rogue, just throw his hands up and say, "Oh, these, it's just random right now." But I know for sure this is not a Mark and sandwich. These are two discrete events. Mark doesn't insert the healing of the boy into the middle of the transfiguration, and he doesn't insert the transfiguration into the middle of the healing of the boy's story. And so for a while I thought I was going to have to do two mini messages this morning, one on the transfiguration and one on the healing of the boy. And so sometimes when I'm kind of stuck, what I like to do is start Googling art, because sometimes something visual will give me some inspiration. And so look what turns out to be the most common image you see when you Google the transfiguration. It's this one. This will sound horrible from an art lover. I'm not a fan of Renaissance painting. I like other parts of Renaissance art, but Renaissance painting isn't my favorite. So when it first popped up and it was the only one that had the two stories together, I was kind of like, eh, but actually it's going to work out pretty good. So this painting is by Raphael. It was painted in 1520. It turns out it's his most famous image. He died shortly before finishing the painting, and so it was actually the final touches were put on by one of his assistants. But while he lay dying, he asked that the painting be moved into the room where he was by his bed so that he could just look at it. And he was somewhere between 37 and 40 when he died. He died very young. This is a huge painting. It's 15 by 9 feet before you put a frame on it. And as I said, it's the only image I found that has the two stories together. So we're going to use it. And we're just going to move around the painting for a center. Sorry, I have to come over here. I wish it was better. It was the best one I could find. But you can see that in this painting, it's almost like there's a horizontal band where the stories break. So up at the top, you see the mountain, which looks a lot like an ottoman, but, you know, it's supposed to be a mountain. We see Jesus. We see Moses on the left, Elijah on the right. And then there's those two guys over there on the left, and they weren't in the text, right? And then down below, we see what's happening in the village. Those are the disciples on the left. Raphael did not paint the scribes. Those are the disciples on the left. You can see the energy in their poses. Some are pointing up and saying, "We should wait till Jesus gets here." Other ones are like, "No, we're going to try one more time, one more time, one more time." We've got this guy down here who has a book, so there's something anachronistic right there. Then over here on the right, we have the townspeople. We've got the father and the boy. And then who's this gal in the middle? There's no. You might say it's the mom, and I kind of thought about that for a minute. So let's talk about the things that Raphael added that aren't in the text. Those two guys on the left up there are the saints of the church that commissioned the painting. And so basically, it's a little bit of marketing for the church, because they're saying, Raphael is saying, you guys could say that if those guys were around at Transfiguration time, they would have been cool enough to be invited. The guy on the bottom on the left with the book, is the disciple Matthew. Because of all the disciples, he wrote a gospel. So he gets this mention here. And then this woman here in the center at the bottom, she represents the church. Again, a little bit of marketing going on. And we know that this triangle that's formed, where you see Jesus at the top and kind of blue and white, these two at the bottom are also wearing blue, and she's kind of blue and whitish. Raphael is contrasting the glory of the heavens with the dinginess and the failures and the flaws of earth, but we don't need to be super worried about that because we have the Word and the church. So that is what Raphael trying to say. And the poor church that paid for this and paid him to paint it, when everybody found out that it was his last painting and there wouldn't be any more Raphaels coming along, the Pope at the time just took it, and it hangs in the Vatican. Where, all right. Okay. So in the text itself that we read, which I hope you were able to remember, and in the painting, there are many Old Testament allusions. There's a lot of Old Testament imagery. And I'm going to do something here now that I've never done, and so I'm scared. But just from what you heard or what you see, can you think of any Old Testament allusions or imagery that are in this painting, in the Transfiguration? You can say what? Cloud, yeah, the cloud. What else? The tablets, Moses and Elijah.
Mountaintop,
it's a mountain, so we have the prophets, we have the law, we have a cloud. Yep, that's all, I think that's it. Then what is a New Testament thing that was in there is the voice, so I want you to remember those things. Okay, let's go to the next thing. Slide, I meant, is what I hope I have there. Yeah. So the Transfiguration is connected to the Hebrew Bible. So we have the phrase that started it, after 6 days. That's a phrase that would resonate with Jewish believers because that's what was said about Moses on the mountaintop, Mount Sinai. We have the high mountain. The mountain in the Old Testament is the place where God reveals himself to humanity. And so there are lots of, and in the sermon notes on the app, I have listed all those Bible verses, so you can double check. Transfigured before them, that's a phrase from the text. Jesus looked transfigured. Again, immediately a Jewish believer would understand, we're talking about something that happened to Moses. And then, of course, we have the actual presence of Moses and Elijah at this event. And they represent the prophetic tradition that anticipated Jesus. And they both were deliverers of Israel themselves, Moses from captivity, Elijah from false gods. We have the cloud, the symbol of glory that accompanied, the presence of God that accompanied the Israelites as they wandered, as they were being led free. And then we have the voice of God that we heard in Mark chapter 1 that says, "This is my son." Peter, James, and John hear the voice again. And I just wonder, we're good. Whenever you're looking at paintings and they mention Peter, James, and John, you probably already know. Peter will be the oldest guy of the trio. John will be the youngest guy in the trio, and therefore James is always the guy in the middle. Now, this is just an aside. Doesn't have anything to do really with what we're talking about today, but the reason our Bible looks the way it looks today, where we have the Old Testament and the New Testament, is basically because the early Christians were not Christians. They were Jews who believed in Jesus. And they saw and kept communicating to the Gentiles as they came in the importance of the Old Testament. And I was just thinking the other day, if that chunk of text we did not have, because if they had just decided, hey, we're going to be a new religion, we don't need that old one, we've got Jesus, we're just going to focus on this Jesus stuff, our Bible and our whole understanding of the New Testament would be radically different. We actually really wouldn't understand much at all. Okay, that was just, I don't know what that was. Mark places the Transfiguration right after Peter's confession in chapter 8. So Wayne talked about that two Sundays ago. Jesus asks, "Who do you say that I am?" And Jesus knows the power of a good question, doesn't he? And Peter responds, "You are the Christ." Now, I know I said earlier that our passage today is not one of those famous Mark and sandwiches. But if you take Mark's gospel as a whole, from chapter 1 to chapter 16, and then you think about what we heard about from Wayne a couple weeks ago about Peter's confession, "You are the Christ," and what we see today as the transfiguration, you would realize that Mark put those in the center of his entire gospel. And as a teaser, when we finally get to chapter 16, we're suddenly going to realize, hey, the whole gospel is a Markan sandwich. And what we hear with Peter's confession and what we learn with the transfiguration illuminates what has happened chapters 1 through 8 and what's going to be happening chapters 9 through 16. So that's a little teaser. Just hang with us for another 3 years while we go through the Gospel of Mark. But Peter's confession, "You are the Christ," does set the tone and the direction for the rest of Mark's gospel. Peter was correct in naming Jesus the Christ, and this is what Wayne talked about 2 weeks ago. But he wasn't correct in what he, Peter, meant when he said that. Correct in name, but not in content. And so Jesus really has some hard work to do to get the disciples to understand what it means that he is the Christ. And we know he's got a lot of hard work to do because, again, 2 weeks ago when Wayne gave us chapter 8, right after Peter identifies Jesus as the Christ and Jesus explains that he's a suffering and dying kind of Messiah, Peter rebukes Jesus. And I think he's shell-shocked, and I think all of the disciples are a little shell-shocked because that's the first what we call passion prediction in the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus comes out and says, "This is what's going to happen." And these disciples are shell-shocked because this is not what they signed up for, not a suffering and a dying Messiah. And these disciples, they might be wobbling in their commitment to Jesus, which might explain why they weren't able to do the exorcism or why Jesus is taking them up to the three of them up to the a mountaintop. These disciples, they're on board with healings and miracles. They might even like the cheering crowds a lot, I don't know. But they're not too keen on suffering, rejection, and death. And therefore, I think therefore, that's my therefore, that's not in the text. Jesus takes three of the disciples, the key disciples, up to the mountain. And there his true nature is revealed to them. They see him as he truly is. They see him from God's vantage point. And it could be that this moment validates Peter's confession for him. And it could be that it reassures these key disciples that despite what Jesus has told them about suffering and rejection, he is the Christ. Edwards, it's the commentary we're using, says, "The transfiguration anticipates the resurrection, and it has the purpose of encouraging the disciples to believe and follow Jesus all the way to the cross." And notice again how Mark has Jesus say, "Don't tell." He gives another one of those famous commands to silence that are throughout the Gospel of Mark. All along in Mark's Gospel, Jesus has been telling people, "Don't say anything about the healing I just did or the exorcism I just performed." He said it 8 times before in this gospel. And this is the 9th time, and it's actually the last time, and it's a little bit different. All the others were an absolute, flat out, "Don't tell." But not this one. He tells them in this one, "Don't say anything about what you've seen until the Son of Man has risen from the dead." Basically, the command to silence ends at the resurrection. And isn't that interesting? What is going on? So thankfully, we have Edwards, again, from the commentary we're using, to help us out. The command to silence reinforces that the cross and resurrection are the only vantage point from which Jesus' life and ministry can be understood according to their divine purpose, and that until the cross and resurrection, all other knowledge of Jesus is peripheral and inadequate. The command to silence is especially pertinent in the afterglow of the Transfiguration. Lest the disciples succumb to the glory and emotional adrenaline of the mountain rather than the necessity of the way to Jerusalem and the cross. The Transfiguration is indeed a preview of the resurrection, but the disciples inherit the Gloria Resurrectionis only through the Via Dolorosa Crucis, the glory of the resurrection only through the painful way of the cross. But in our next verses in the text that we read in the beginning, Mark shows us that the disciples are very confused still and maybe a little bit stubborn in holding on to their misunderstanding. As they walk down the mountain, they are talking among themselves. What does rising from the dead mean? I don't get it. What's going on? And so they toss out a question to Jesus. Hey, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? I think they want to get back to basics. What's going to happen first? What's next? What's the order of the events? Have we got this straight yet? Is it when Elijah returns and restores harmony among God's people? That's an understanding of Elijah's role in the coming of the Messiah that comes from Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6. And it was a common understanding in the day that Elijah would precede the Messiah, and it would be the signal that all things would be restored. And I think what these three disciples are wondering is like, well, if Elijah's coming and he's going to restore all things, maybe there's no need for the Messiah, for Jesus to die. And how does Jesus respond to this? He responds by affirming Elijah's role in the restoration of things. He says, yes, Malachi 4, 5, and 6, you're right. And then he asks the disciples a question. So, fellas, why do you think then it's written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? I think basically he's saying, you know there are other scriptures in the Old Testament. He wouldn't have called it the Old Testament. You know there are other scriptures besides Malachi. Why are you ignoring Isaiah, where it says the servant of the Lord will be despised and rejected? And then Jesus says, yes, Elijah has come, and they've done everything to him that they wished, just as it was written about him. Jesus is connecting two people, Elijah and John the Baptizer, two events, two storylines into the big story. Elijah, a prophet of Israel, was opposed by the rulers Ahab and Jezebel. John the Baptizer, a prophet of Israel, was opposed by Herod and his wife Herodias. Jezebel threatened Elijah's life. He had to run for his life away from her. Herodias threatened John the Baptizer's life, and she had John the Baptizer beheaded. John is Elijah, the forerunner of the Messiah. And so Jesus' point here, I think, is that why should you disciples be shocked about the fate of the Messiah when you've already seen what they've done to John the Baptizer, who is Elijah, the forerunner of the Messiah. Well, you can imagine what the walk down the mountain was like. They have literally had a mountaintop experience. They saw Jesus as the physical embodiment of God's glory. They saw two of their heroes of the faith, Elijah and Moses, talking to Jesus. They have seen Jesus connected to the promises of God. They have heard God's voice. And yet this mountaintop experience is already dissipating even before they've left the mountain. They head into town and they look for the rest of the disciples. And what do they find? A large crowd of people around the disciples and an argument going on between the disciples and the teachers of the law. We often hear them called the scribes. And I think these teachers of the law, they're arguing, but they're enjoying this argument. They're very happy about what is going on because they see that the disciples seem to be helpless without Jesus. And perhaps it was Jesus' earlier statement back in chapter 8 that he was going to die that has rattled the disciples. And either way, that is good for the scribes because they began plotting way back in chapter 3 along with the Pharisees on how they were going to kill Jesus. And so this little episode is confirmation that once Jesus is out of the way, the disciples are helpless. This whole Messiah movement, this guy who can't manage to keep Sabbath law, practice personal piety, it'll be over as soon as Jesus is gone. So I would like you to close your eyes for just a minute, and I would like you to visualize this scene as it's written by Mark, not as painted by Raphael. So you need to get rid of the church lady. You need to get rid of Matthew's book. You need to bring back the teachers of the law. Do you have the scene in mind? Who is overlooked or forgotten while the disciples and teachers argue and the crowd watches? The Father. You can open your eyes now. So Jesus walks into the scene that you just pictured, and he asks, "What are you arguing about?" And who answers the question? Not the disciples, not the teachers of the law, nobody in the crowd. And maybe that's because now that Jesus is there, the argument seems less important or irrelevant or embarrassing. Who answers the question? It's the father of the boy possessed by a spirit. The man who has been waiting for Jesus, waiting for help, the one in need, although everyone has taken their eyes from him. "Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." The father's answer dismays Jesus. "O unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you?" I don't think for a minute that Jesus' response is directed to the Father. I think Jesus is responding to the entire scene. The crowds, the arguing disciples, the teachers, everyone's taken their eyes from what is important. They've forgotten the Father. They've lost sight of what matters. And the disciples in particular are exhibiting that spiritual blindness that Wayne talked about from the chapter before, where Jesus says, "Those who have ears, let them hear. Those who have eyes, let them see." And this lament, "O unbelieving generation," that comes from the mouth of Jesus, it reveals his humanity, I think. Mark is not afraid to show us that Jesus had strong emotions. I think Jesus is running out of patience, and he's exasperated. I mean, we're in chapter 9. In chapter 6, he sent them out to practice being disciples without him, and they actually did very well. They cast out demons. They were healing people. And Jesus knows where he is going. He knows he's going to the cross. He knows he's running out of time, and they still have so much to learn. And Jesus, in his questions, reminds everyone what is present, what they have clearly forgotten, that the father and the boy are here and they're waiting. They are what is important right now at this moment, not the reputations of the disciples, not the political plans of the scribes, not the entertainment wishes of the crowd. Bring the boy to me, Jesus says. And as soon as the boy is present, the demon attacks. Jesus immediately shows compassion and empathy. He asks the boy's father a question: how long has he been like this? And we learn how terrifying life has been for the father, trying to keep his child safe, to keep his child alive, to keep him from being burned or drowned. And he says to Jesus, but if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. I'd like you to notice that he's not asking Jesus to heal the child. There is a specific word in Greek that Mark has used many, many times before in this book that means to be healed or to be made well. It sounds like he's simply asking Jesus to help them, to come to their aid. I do know that help means healing also. When I put myself in the story, I wonder if the father has perhaps given up on healing, that he's lowered his expectations, he's given up on hope, he's gotten used to disappointment. If you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And maybe all that he hopes for at this moment is some respite care and some kosher meals organized by the local synagogue. If there's anything you can do, then please help us. And how does Jesus respond? If I can, all things are possible for the one who believes, the one who trusts. Do you see how Jesus has just opened the door to hope? And the man cries out. He shouts, is what the Greek says. Maybe as if to convince himself as well as Jesus, I trust, I believe, but help me. That same word, help me. Come to my aid in the places I don't trust. And Jesus takes that mustard seed of trust and he turns it into a life-giving tree for this father and son. He heals the boy. I believe, but help my unbelief. I trust, but help my lack of trust. I have never read a more perfect description of faith. Not a definition of faith, but a description. This is what faith really looks like in you and me. This is what it looks like when we walk on this journey with Jesus. I believe, but help my unbelief. I trust, but help my lack of trust. You probably have many examples of feeling that way. I know I do. Flannery O'Connor writes, she's a great writer, she's not a theologian, but she writes novels that have a lot of theology in them. She wrote, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief, is the most natural and most human and most agonizing prayer in the Gospels. And I think it is the foundation prayer of faith. And Frederick Buechner, whom we just lost recently, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief, is the best any of us can do really, but thank God it is enough. Notice, too, how Jesus cares for the disciples. After their failure, he takes them into a house away from the crowds, and he spends some time teaching them. The disciples ask him, why weren't we able to drive out the demon? And Jesus says, this kind can only come out by prayer. I'm sure he said many, many, many more things, but typically, this is all that Mark gives us. And so Mark is telling us there's something important in these words from Jesus. So it's important, yes, but how? In what way? Is Mark trying to tell us that there's some hierarchy of demons? We got to get the spreadsheet out so we know which ones are the easy peasy ones, which ones are the middle of the road ones, and which ones are the really tough ones? No. He's showing us that there is no discipleship without prayer, that prayer is indispensable. Not so we can be miracle workers, but so we can see the world as God sees it, so no one is overlooked, See where help is needed. Feel the world the way God feels it. Enter into the suffering on behalf of others. In prayer, we acknowledge our weakness, our lack of trust, and we rely on God's strength and God's love. Mark is reminding us that prayer is indispensable. Prayer is key to discipleship. That's the first takeaway. The second one's a little bit longer. We need mountains and valleys. To be a disciple, a follower of Jesus, means that we will experience both, and we need to. Maybe you've had a mountaintop experience, a moment, a time, a space where God has revealed something to you. Maybe you've experienced his healing love, or you've understood the call that he's placed on your life. Maybe there was an answer to prayer. Maybe you've even experienced a miracle. Transfiguration spaces bring us to our knees in awe and wonder at this God whose ways are not our ways and whose thoughts are not our thoughts. And we want to stay there forever, pitch a tent, and hang out there. It gives us what we used to call a spiritual high. It feels so good. The air is rearranged. Like, this is what it means to be a disciple. We finally figured out this disciple thing. And when this happens, brace yourself. Because God has a way of making sure that we never try to tame him, to keep him in a theological box, especially just to suit us. Peter, James, and John got that lesson on the way down the mountain. They just had this mountaintop experience, and they learned more about the foreshadowing that Jesus would be killed in the same way John the Baptizer was killed. We need the valleys. We cannot stay on the mountaintop, because a spiritual high does not always make us other-focused. What I mean is that these experiences do not teach us everything we need to know about being a follower of Jesus. We learn that in the valley, in our everyday lives, where God's presence is much more difficult to discern. In the valleys, though, we learn that the compassionate heart of God, this is This is another commentary. It's actually on if any of you follow the lectionary, this website, which I think is going to be on the saltproject.org, publishes a lectionary commentary weekly, and this is from the one for this for these verses. We learn that the compassionate heart of God is most powerfully revealed amidst the broken, the sinful, the suffering, and the despairing. The kingdom of God shines most brightly against the backdrop of the parent who grieves, the child who cries, the demons who oppress, and the disciples who try but fail to manufacture the holy. God's strength is made perfect in our weakness. God's beauty is best contained in broken vessels. We might not like this aspect of faith, but it's an aspect that has much to teach us. The discipline of the valley happens in the valley. Finding God in the ordinary requires dwelling in the ordinary. We learn quotidian holiness only in the seconds, minutes, hours, and days of our regular lives. There are no shortcuts. God is not in the business of offering us permanent real estate on the mountaintop. So here's the great challenge of Christian life. Can we speak glory to agony and agony to glory? Can we hold the mountain and the valley as one, denying neither and embracing both? Can we do this hard work out of love and compassion for each other so that no one among us is left to hurt and suffer in the places where God's presence is harder to discern? I would like at least one more mountaintop experience in my life. I've had one. But they seem to happen on God's timing. We can't schedule or control the moments when the veil between heaven and earth either grows thin or is parted. What we are asked to do is to follow Jesus on the road. Where we sometimes easily see God at work in the bright light, but we often fail to see God in the shadows, and in the spaces between. On the road, there is joy and love, and there is sorrow and pain and unanswered prayer. What we are asked to do on the road is to see the world as God sees it and to continue learning to be his disciples. Will you pray with me? Loving Christ, give us the grace to walk with you. You are there in a refugee's desert of hope. You are there in the patient's waiting room of despair. You are there in the war victim's ruins. Give us the strength to die to our separateness, to die to our priorities. Give us the courage to hold compassion and empathy for those who suffer. Help us to keep our eyes on you, Jesus, to hold your hand, to go where you go, to follow you on the long road. Amen.